You're listening to Visionaries by Wonder, a podcast where CEOs, founders, and leaders share their success stories with their host, Jeannie O, the founder of Wonder and an award-winning product strategy and UX design firm. We'll be exploring the world and connecting with inspiring individuals. Join us.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of The Visionaries, the podcast where we explore the minds of extraordinary individuals who are making a difference in the world. Today, we have a special guest who has worn many hats and exits throughout his career as an entrepreneur. He's also an expert in solving complex computing problems, and he's particularly passionate about building solutions that scale, especially in cloud computing. His strength lies in the startup realm, where he has deep technical and business experiences in bringing ideas from concept to market. Our guest today is the founder of Mile Marker, a company that's bridging the gap between the cost and knowledge barriers for companies in need of software development. He started Mile Marker because he watched too many friends fail due to bad relationships with developers that had built businesses focused on bigger projects and bigger clients. And through Mile Marker, he has been able to create positive impacts through software and further his goal of contributing to the greater social good. So, Daniel, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
We're super excited. And you and I actually have something in common. I learned from Eric Smith, one of our other podcast guests that we had on the show, that you are also 30, just like me. And I love hearing other young entrepreneurs' journey of how they got to where they are today. So can you share with us how you got to be so successful at such a young age?
Yeah. No, that's awesome. It's my dad's fault that I'm an entrepreneur.
Blame it on the dad.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it can't be my fault, right? He's really an entrepreneurial person. That said, he's a CPA business manager, but he really started getting me involved in little new ideas that he had at a pretty young age. So small stuff where, you know, he was shooting photos for fun and realized that in West Hollywood during Halloween, there's these crazy costumes and all that, and no one has a camera with them. This was kind of pre-camera phones being any good. And so we went out there.
Pre-TikTok.
Yeah, exactly. So we went out there and shot photos and sold photos online the next day to people. You know, they gave them a little business card and they could go buy them the next day. So it started kind of with little stuff like that, that my dad was able to show me, you know, okay, it's time to build a website. We got to figure out how to do that. I made him take me to, I think it was Barnes & Noble, and bought HTML and CSS for Dummies, quite like literally that book. And that was how I learned to build the website that we needed and wanted. And from there, I really started to enjoy building websites and building them around business ideas more than the tech side of it, honestly. And that just kind of grew and continued into building businesses and realizing that I love writing code and there's ways to get paid to do that, ways to have a big impact doing that. And it's kind of been the focus since.
Wow. So you had a really great mentor from an early age that showed you possibilities of innovation. I'm curious, what was the first website that you have built out?
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know. There were so many of them that I just made something up and built out. I mean, back then it could have been realistically something tied to like World of Warcraft, because that was what I was doing all the time. You know, if I wasn't in school, I was playing World of Warcraft. But I think the first like real kind of thing I did was build a website selling services, building websites. And that was, you know, where it really started at probably 15 years old, realizing people would pay me to do that. And I started consulting and started, you know, building little simple HTML, CSS websites, and eventually got a job, an internship, whatever you want to call it, at a dev firm, and just kind of grew it from there.
Wow, that's a really cool job, like while you're in high school, right? It's like most kids are working at Starbucks, working minimum wage, and here you are, you're consulting, you're building websites for people and going into development. And I'm curious if you've ever had a client or someone tell you like, oh my gosh, you're like a kid, you're building my website? What?
So when I was, I mean, honestly, my first client that was truly like a random person that wasn't connected to the family, I'll never forget kind of how it all went down. But my dad taught me the lesson, and she taught me the lesson of, even if I'm right, she's the client. And so it doesn't really matter. And I learned some of those lessons at a really young age, you know, and that was cool. But definitely have had a fair share of like the kind of, you're too young to be our CTO, you're too young to be an advisor, you're too young to start this thing. And, you know, I think in tech, at least at my age and when I got into tech, it was at a point where there were some people before us who had kind of bridged that gap of age is not that important here. And so that was helpful to follow in the footsteps of some others. But yeah, I still am self-conscious about it. I had a lead that I was talking to earlier today as part of our sales process say, you know, ask how old I was. And I kind of panicked for a minute.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, whatever, you know, they get to know. And I was like, I'm 30. And thankfully he was like, oh, you're only a year older than me. And I was like, oh, okay. But, you know, yeah. I had no idea.
Yeah, I so relate to everything you just shared. Like I've been in moments where people were interested. Like I went to like these conferences, we had a booth set up and everything. One particular memory that pops up in my head was this guy. He was like super interested in our portfolio work. He was like amazed with everything that we were doing. And then he's just like, oh, so like, who's the founder? And I'm like, oh, it's me. And he just like looked in such dismay, like, oh, aren't you too young to be running your own business? And I'm like, I don't even have a comeback for that. Like, no, I don't know what to say here.
I feel like you don't need one because you don't want to do business with them. Doesn't yeah. matter how much money they have, what they can offer you, like, whatever, I don't need you.
Yeah, yeah. You
know, that's always been my approach with it. But yeah, it's bonkers how many people find out at some point, you know, how old you really are and then just yeah. kind of get weird about it.
They do, yeah. And I would wear, right now I'm not wearing makeup, but purposely I would wear like darker makeup that would make me look older. And I'm sure that's part of the reason why you grew out your beard, like just to look a little bit older, right?
For sure. And that was actually, so when I was starting my first company in college, and I couldn't grow a beard back then. And, you know, my dad actually bought me like a briefcase, like a nice Tumi bag, you know, and he was like, it was something he had bought himself when he started his company that he said it kind of just gave him that confidence walking into a meeting and presenting at least more mature, you know, you can't necessarily present older necessarily, but like more mature. And so I've thought about it ever since then, but I think there's also just an amount of imposter syndrome with that.
Oh yeah, like, for sure.
We're young, but we're not inexperienced, you know, and we kind of forget that one of those matters more than the other.
Yeah, definitely. And it's always putting yourself in the mentality of how can I help this person versus how can I show them or how can I prove to them that I'm worth the value? It's more like, what's the value you're going to give them and focus on that. And at least for me, that's what's helped get over the imposter syndrome because I've had many years of it.
Yeah, for sure. There's always someone out there who, you know, is quote unquote further along than you.
Yeah. So what advice would you give to young entrepreneurs who are, you know, going through similar phases? They're probably in their early 20s and they're in their first business and they're having that imposter syndrome and they're getting those self-doubts. What advice do you have for young entrepreneurs like that?
It's a great question. It's kind of tough to answer because everyone's kind of different. And I think the root cause behind everyone's imposter syndrome is a little bit different. But I think the real answer to an extent comes back to what I said earlier of like, you don't need that guy in your You know, if someone isn't giving you that respect that you've earned, you've worked hard for, screw it, move on. You know, and there's going to be people who support you for who you are and what you've achieved. And there's going to be the people who are a bit backwards and just look at it as, you know, you're young and you can't possibly know which way is up. And it's like, it's just nuts.
I mean, it's like they found their way to you somehow. So, you know, there's something to be learned there.
Yeah, you were referred to me.
Yeah.
Someone else thought you should talk to me.
Yeah, so, and it's always the ego that's like, oh, I'm not going to take advice or recommendation from someone younger, but it's all ego, you know.
It 100% is, yeah. And that's even as an employer, like looking at my team and I do sometimes think about when I hire people older than me, how will they feel about that and what does that look like? But even when I hire people younger than me, being really clear with them of like, speak up. I'm not perfect. I know that. I don't know. You know, I'm at the end of the day, I'm just doing my best and it's not going to be perfect. So speak up.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And I recall the first time I've hired someone who is significantly older than me, like the amount of like nerves and like, you know, are they going to want to even work with me? And then when they said yes to working at our company, I was like, oh my God, we finally have a dad in the company.
Yeah.
Like we're becoming a mature, you know, next phase of growth. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it is kind of like that though. And that's part of the imposter syndrome and part of the being uncomfortable, being young and being in a leadership position. But I think at the end of the day, you just got to keep going. You know,
definitely.
You can't let it stop you. It's going to happen. Be comfortable with it happening and just keep pushing on.
I love that. Yeah. And so just going into your past experiences, because you have such an amazing portfolio of success and you've had a couple acquisitions in your journey prior to Mile Marker. So tell us a little bit more about those experiences.
Yeah. So there's been a few. I think one of the things that happened to me in my journey is I've been in a lot of industries. So I look at founders as being industry specific and industry agnostic. And for me, being generally a CTO, it's a experience where as long as I have the right partners, it doesn't really matter. We can kind of build tech for whatever industry. But so when in college, we started a company called Fetch Rewards, that's continued to grow and is now is now a unicorn. And that was a great experience. That was the first one that I think was quote unquote real in a sense. We had someone else's money in our bank account. We went through that process. We figured out how to build and grow a team for the first time. And that was really when we were like young and that feeling of imposter syndrome was there and trying not to build up the ego too much was there and, you know, just trying to be cognizant of those things. But it was a great experience. Dropped out of school at one point for it. And yeah, the company's continued to grow and thrive, and that's been really exciting to watch.
Involved in that company now?
No longer. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, at some point, we had dropped out of school, and it was time to go back to school. Is kind of the gist of it. So I wanted to get my degree and graduate, and you know, that was the path. But yeah, so after that, went back to school and started another company in the weightlifting space. And that was a really good learning experience. Ultimately, shut that company down for zero. But really learned what that failure feels like and looks like. And not how to avoid it, you know, how to avoid it in that one particular instance, maybe, but like failure comes in all shapes and sizes and looks very different, but it was a really good experience in terms of growing a team with very little money. We never raised quite as much. We never really had the sales. we built a really cool product because we had two very technical founders, myself and my co-founder Pete, who, you know, we just worked on the product all day, and someone needs to work on sales. And it was just one of those reminders and lessons in, like, you got to build a business, not a product. And a lot of technical founders that I talk to fail to see that often in the early days.
Yeah, I've seen some of those too, where it's like, you have really technical founders, they build super cool products, and then they don't know what to do with it. And they're like, oh, we have this AI that does your homework for you, and it's cool, but now what? Like, you built something, this is awesome, you should sell it, you know, business mindset. And they're like, oh no, I don't even know how to do it. I'm like,
well, and I think a big part of it is, like, it's solution in search of a problem, right? As technologists, I could sit here all day and optimize the heck out of everything we do, but at the end of the day, that's not moving the needle for the business and for the users necessarily, right? So I think getting more user-centric, more customer-centric, it was really the realization that I had, and it's bled into Mile Marker in the way in which we approach new projects and new products, starting with problem statements, starting with, and this is kind of a pet peeve of mine, but like user problem statements, not the problem in society that you want to solve, but the problem for each individual user and each individual player that you're solving. Because ultimately, often no one has society's problems, right? No one's KPIs are society's problems. They have their own problems that all play into those bigger problems.
Yeah, nobody wants to solve for like global warming or wars or anything like that. It's always, how can we, you know, better project manage so we get more efficiency out of this company?
Right. Yeah. It's just, it's not people's KPIs, right?
Yeah.
Like, no one has the KPI that Americans are unhealthy. Right. I mean, someone does, it's the government, but like no one really does. Right. If you're selling to a hospital, it's not really anyone's KPI at that hospital.
So is that something that you're teaching your clients at Mile Marker? And can we also dive into what you do there? Just so that the audience has an understanding of the work that you do.
Yeah, totally. So Mile Marker. So, okay. So after, about 5 years ago, we sold a company to a big corporate business. And when I was leaving the big corporate business, which I don't, I'm an entrepreneur, I don't function well in big corporate America. So when I was leaving that company and starting to try to figure out what was next, I started playing fractional CTO for a few startups and realized that there's a really big need for that in the early stage development process, and that the market was not really geared towards that set of needs. And so I started Mile Marker to try to fill that gap. So with Mile Marker, we function as a product development studio, as a fractional CTO, as a comprehensive product team. We, you know, there's a lot of kind of words that we throw around, but at the end of the day, we're your tech partner in an early stage business. So we can provide fractional CTO, design, development, QA, DevOps, SecOps, you know, whatever really needs to get done to get product to market. And our focus is on getting product to market, not building the coolest software or the sexiest thing or the most optimized thing or, you know, any of that. It's really just get product to market, get users on board, and go from there.
I'm sure you get a lot of pushback, though, from your clients, like, because when you're working with founders, they have such a vision for what they're wanting, right? And so your goal as a fractional CTO is, let's cut time, let's cut resources, get to market as soon as possible. That doesn't necessarily align with their vision. So how do you manage that conversation, and how do you get to a sweet spot with those types of clients, which, I don't know, I feel like are the majority?
For sure. So we start the process usually with what we call a strategic alignment workshop. And that's where we end up building out a roadmap and backlog and user stories, as well as more data models and architectures and things like that. But that's where we really get aligned in what we're going to build. And Did Eric talk about VEP when he was on?
Yes, he did. Yeah. Value, effort. Yeah. We had a whole conversation around that. Yeah. So
I won't repeat the whole thing about VEP, but we follow processes like VEP to help, founders find that clarity around what is actually important to build, what's going to have positive payoff, what's just a Me Too feature. And we help get them aligned. But I think part of our approach that's a bit unique is we are very strict about being agile. So we don't do any fixed bid projects because those are inherently waterfall. We truly follow agile. And so when our clients get subscribed to that mentality, they know that while we may be going to production with what feels to them like version 0.2, we have plans for 0.3, 0.4, point, you know, up until 5.0. And so I think it makes it a little bit easier for them, especially when they see rapid releases every day, every week, whatever it may be. So, but it's a hurdle because people have a vision.
Of course. Totally. Yeah. So how do they buy into that agile mentality? Is it like series of conversations or is it, you know, your track record? Like what is it that they're finally like, okay, I trust Daniel and his team and we're going to buy into this agile mentality?
Yeah. So generally, our clients fall in one of two buckets. So technical clients where they have a technical team on hand or they are technical themselves. It's not much of a sales pitch. They know that that's the way software gets built these days. For the non-technical founders that we work with, by the time we're talking to them, they've heard the word agile, their advisors are telling them to be agile, their buddy who works at Google is telling them to be agile, you know, like everyone we've talked to about their idea and the development side of it is telling them to be agile. What we're doing is showing them a way that agile can work for them and giving them that comfort that it is possible to have a budget and still be agile and to follow, you know, a kind of waterfallish vision, but still be agile and allow for minor corrections along the way.
And so how do you then prioritize like their software development needs and still balancing their vision, the costs and time constraints?
Yeah. So a lot of that is getting it aligned with their reality. So, you know, they all have this vision for this massive product and it's this perfect thing and it works perfectly. But at the end of the day, if you take, for example, a B2B company that's going to onboard 5 new customers next year, they don't need onboarding to be a automated process or even a process that is able to be done by them. We can do it for them. We can be their team that helps support with those operations. And so we can cut out some of those features that are obviously necessary if they're going to scale, but they're not going to scale in the next year, you know? And so we can trim a lot of the cost in those ways and get them to focus on what's actually going to move the needle from a sales and usage and engagement perspective. You know, be a development team who really looks to impact the sales team and the marketing team, rather than, you know, trying to impact the business or the like to build a crazy product for.
Yeah. I think that's such a great advice for founders to just continue to think about. It's like, how are you going to empower the sales and marketing team with what you're building today? Because again, everybody has this big vision of what the product should be and they're so fixated on that. But you know, what is the value that you can deliver today to the hands of your customers? Get them to provide that feedback before you build more onto your current product.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we have a product we're going to release tomorrow that the first release into production is purely for sales to go demo the product. And it is ready for a user, and we know that. But we also know what the sales cycle is going to be, and it will be ready even if someone buys on Monday.
Yeah.
You know, so it's fine to kind of look at the first thing you have to do, which is get a customer, get users, get people on board, you know, and not delight 100% and not make everyone fall in love with your product. That's not the goal out of the gate.
Yeah. Yeah. To me, that's like entrepreneurship 101. It's not even how to build a technical product, but it's like, if you want any kind of business, like who's your first customer? Let them like pay for your operations before you invest hundreds of thousands of dollars into a company that has zero validation.
Yeah. I think the really hard thing is it's entrepreneurship 101. It's business 101. But when you are the founder of a company, it's so easy to overlook those things. They're so hard to do. This is your baby that you're working on 80, 90, 100 hours a week.
Yeah.
You don't want to settle for good enough. You
just of course.
Don't. So, you know, with that, I feel as though I know one, maybe two companies that have like truly followed the lean startup or truly followed the, you know, name a book, but like, there's just not that many that really follow the book.
Yeah. So do you feel that those two companies that have followed that book have found an immense amount of success compared to the other companies that haven't?
They've both exited.
Oh, well, there you go.
I mean, yeah. And it's just what that success looked like and how it felt along the way. I mean, I was a third party observer to those, but it felt and looked like the founders were not, and in conversations with them, they just weren't as anxious in a sense about having a business tomorrow.
Yeah.
They weren't burning capital at the same rate some of these others are. And so they knew that by the time they went through what money they had, they'd be able to raise again because they're burning it so slowly, they won't ramp it up until they have revenues. And it's easier to raise when you have revenues. So,
Yeah, you know, definitely.
It's just, it's kind of, it's actually probably a less stressful and better experience for founders, I think.
Yeah. And it's, as you said, it's easier to raise capital when there is revenue, when there is track record versus spending all that money on trying to get to a proof of concept or something else.
Yeah. We turn down a lot of business that we think is spending money in a way that's not strategic by paying. So, you know, if we have someone come to us and they want to build a product and they have no users, they have no customers, they have no one signed, no one is saying I'm going to use it.
Yeah.
We don't build it.
Yeah. Because then you don't want to be liable for their success or failure.
At the end of the day, our company's success is going to be defined by our client's success.
Yeah.
Right? Like either the way that we're positioning it, we're not trying to win design awards. We're not trying to win development awards. Our success is going to be have your clients successfully exited.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I have to pick winners in a sense.
Yeah, it's a good KPI. And I'm curious. So one of the things that I've observed with tech companies, you know, people trying to raise capital in Silicon Valley is that having an in-house tech team is almost like a vanity metric of like, how many engineers do you have? And like, where, like, what companies did they come from and things like that? And I'm sure you've heard about it. And I'm curious if you see that, if you agree to that, like, what's your, where's your stance at that?
I think if you're starting a computer vision company and you have no technical people in house, that's a problem. You're starting an AI company and you have no one tech, you know, you're starting a true tech company. You need to have some people in house. Now, if you're starting a company that's really, at the end of the day, a services business that uses software to streamline that, you really don't need a tech team in house necessarily, especially, let's say, years one and two.
Yeah.
So if you're, so the other place where we fit in really well is with these companies that do have tech teams in house that are highly specialized. So a lot of our clients are AI companies where they have AI teams in house. They shouldn't build a mobile app or a web app. You're not getting acquired for it. You're getting acquired for your data model, your, you know, so it should be strategic how you hire and staff those teams. But the other thing that I feel somewhat strongly about is that when you start to bring in and compare the price of bringing in a team in-house versus an external team, it becomes a lot clearer that to bring in a team in-house, you're going to have to do without.
Yeah.
So our price point lands us at about, you know, the equivalent of a full-time engineer in-house. But we bring to the table designers, QA, DevOps, SecOps, you know, all these other parts and pieces that it's pretty rare to find one engineer that can do all those things.
Yeah.
And so from a risk perspective, it often doesn't make sense either. I agree that at the end of the day, it's not that important. It's kind of assumed. If you can sell into a market, you can get customers on board, your VC knows a tech guy that can come in and run the show, or, you know, a CTO that is on the bench right now. So they'll staff it. They can afford it. It's just money can buy that. What they don't know how to do is penetrate a market. They don't know how to get sales. They, you know, that's what they're really buying when they invest in your company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like the examples you gave, which is, you know, if it's a true tech, like it's complex technology that you have to build out, you definitely need a tech team in-house. But if it's something that's more service-oriented, heavy on operations, you know, let's say like Uber is essentially an operations company that has, you know, mobile app that helps facilitate that operation. So I can see that being more outsourced and it'll be okay, as opposed to like OpenAI, where your whole team better be engineers.
Yeah. And that's, it's funny because actually Uber is a good example of that I use a lot in how to break down a very early stage MVP. So if you're a founder and your vision is Uber, that's great. We're not going to build that out of the gate. So you have to start picking the hypotheses that you're going to test.
Yeah.
And, you know, you might want to replace the phone call that the customer makes to the taxi cab company. And so maybe they submit a form online, it goes to someone's email that they're always watching, and they pick up the phone and call the cab or the radio, whatever it is. You know, you got to pick one or two places and start replacing those interactions with tech.
Yeah.
So to kind of circle back to that conversation, I think that's how you start to break it down and show that vision, where we will get to your vision, but we got to start small.
Yeah. I'm sure you've heard so many people saying like, I want an Uber for dog sitting. I want an Airbnb for, cars or whatever it is.
The other thing that we hear often is exactly that, where they come to you and they say to us, they're like, I want Uber for dog sitting. And I go, oh, you mean Rover?
Yeah,
but ours is going to be better. And I'm like, how's it going to be better? And they're like, I don't know. We have, you know, $40,000. Can we build it?
Yeah.
They carry so much money. Like,
it's like, yeah, ours is going to be better because it has this feature. But it's like, do you understand how much money they've burned to get to where they are now? And you're going to try to make it better? Like,
Exactly. And I think there are opportunities where that's possible. But I think that's where Eric's VEP system really helped to say, look, that's just not a competitive advantage. Like it just isn't. That's a, you know, 3 value and a 3 effort.
Yeah.
You're not going to compete on it.
Yeah. You got to find something that's 5 in value, 1 in effort. And that's your sweet spot.
Yeah. And then build just that. Don't build any of the other features.
The notifications, the messages, right.
That's like, we'll get to the point where people can upload a profile picture. They don't need that day one, right?
Exactly. And in your experience as a fractional CTO, what are some of the most common technical challenges that early stage companies face, and how do you help them overcome those challenges?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest ones for B2B companies right now is security and compliance. And it's a real hassle when you're a 2-person company, right? But if your target customers are SOC 2 compliant and certified, they kind of need you to be reasonable as well.
Yeah.
And so in that scenario, number one, it starts with just good AWS architecture. and good process. So we have a lot of process in place between understanding a requirement and that going into production. A lot of checks and balances, a lot of just double checking and access controls that mm-hmm. are important. But one of the things that exists these days, especially with AWS, but Azure and Google Cloud the same, is they just have these amazing tools that you just click three buttons and you can now say that you have automated vulnerability scanning, you have automated vulnerability detection. So if you go through the motions and set those things up correctly, you can get through an IT audit.
Gotcha. But it's
one of the bigger challenges that's scary to founders, especially non-technical, that doesn't need to be. But IT is very serious about it, and so they take it seriously. And that's an important thing to show up to that meeting with a lot of authority and with the data to back it up and the documentation and the proof points. And if you show up looking to learn from their IT, they're just going to shut it down. They don't have time for that. They're out, and you have to go through a new sales cycle.
Mm. So it sounds like with AWS and Azure and Cloud, it's, as you said, it's easy to set up those securities. It's just a few clicks of a button. So why are so many founders missing that?
They don't know. Mm. A lot of developers, you tell them, hey, we need this built. They go set it up. They put it on a server and they say, here it is. And now the founder has no idea whether or not those things are in place. They have no idea what's been done or hasn't been done. And so then they get themselves caught in a IT meeting where IT is just shutting it down. I think there's a lot of ways to go wrong with your configuration as well. And so if you don't have the right partner, dev partner, developer, whatever, in-house or external, you just get yourself into a situation where no one knows, no one's thinking about it.
Yeah. So how can they be better prepared, or how can they prevent this from happening? I mean, one, you said having the right technical founder or technical partner, right? So I guess it's a two-folded question. One, how do you find the right technical partner that's going to understand all of those securities? And then two, how can they be more smart about it if they don't have the right partner?
Yeah, so I'll start with being more aware or smart. And I think aware is honestly more important than smart, to be honest. I think when you show up to a meeting with IT and you're totally unaware of what SOC 2 is or what ITAR is or, any of their requirements, they just, it looks negligent to approve you. And so they're not going to approve you. But there's a lot of education materials out there that you can read. OWASP, O-W-A-S-P, which I'm blanking on what it stands for. They have their set of training materials and guidelines to read that honestly are not super technical and boring and painful. They could be good for anyone. Understanding what SOC 2 is, understanding, who your customer is. If they are healthcare, look into HIPAA, get a bit of an understanding about it. If they are... just know their industry is kind of the key. As far as finding the right dev partner, I think there's a lot of dating to do. You just got to date a few different people and a few different firms and figure out which one you're comfortable with. But I think for early stage founders, relying on your advisors, on your friends, on your network that can help both point you in the right direction to smart people and to good partners, but also validate and interview and confirm that the person you're going to work with is the right person.
Yeah. I think that's such a great advice, especially for anyone who has not had technical partners or never gone down, working with tech, what I've seen is, some founders who just get married to the first technical person that they meet in their network. Like, oh my God, I found the CTO and that's it. Like that's my partner, ride or die. And, you know, what you said, which is you got to find the person that you're comfortable with and date as many CTOs and dev shops as possible and understand like who's going to work with you through all the tribulations, basically.
Yeah. You have to also, and I tell a lot of founders this, but you have to leave yourself room. So there's, if you find someone who, I'm going to back that up. So there's two types of CTOs. There's your early stage CTO and your later stage CTO. Early stage, and I'm going to say air quote CTO, is someone who can build your product and get it into market. Your later stage CTO builds your tech division, your department. They have hiring processes and policies and management and blah, blah, blah. So those are very rarely the same person. Very rarely. And so in the early days, when you find that quote unquote CTO that can build your product, maybe bring them on as a director of technology or as a VP. You know, don't bring them in right away because now you're setting yourself up for a really awkward conversation. Right?
Yeah.
But that's also where like us serving as a fractional CTO and a comprehensive team can come in and relieve you of that. And that you don't necessarily need a CTO full time in the first year or two. You need someone strategically planning for sure. But really what you need is someone to build your product and get it into market. And calling that person your CTO is tough. It just sets you up for that weird conversation when you bring in the real CTO or the,
later. Yeah, it's like your first boyfriend or girlfriend is probably not who you're going to end up marrying. So be careful who you put a ring on.
Exactly. And it doesn't mean that they're the wrong fit for the time. They're the right fit for the time. You could have a lot of fun and everything be good and part ways amicably, but that's because everyone's aware of that situation. Everyone goes into it kind of thinking that.
Yeah. That's an interesting way to think about it too. It's like, now that I think about it, a lot of people do get married into like, the person building the product has to be the CTO. But as you said, it's a very different skill set. Like later stage, it's about the process. It's about how fast you can build your engineering team. It's about managing. You're almost not even touching how the product is being built as a later stage CTO. Two questions on that, I guess. One, for someone who has built that product, how can they acquire the skills to become the later stage CTO? Let's start with that question first.
Yeah, I think, my answer is going to be somewhat biased in the way that I learn. And I'm not a big, I don't read all the documentation then get started. I get started and read the documentation as I go. And so part of my answer is you just got to start practicing and start doing those things. And it's a really difficult thing to do because you're really comfortable writing code. You're really comfortable in your IDE. You're really comfortable just sitting at a keyboard, but you need to get yourself into PowerPoint and you need to go make a slide deck that justifies your budget. You need to get yourself into Excel and put together a 2-year, 3-year projection of what you're going to need to spend, who you need to hire, when, and getting those reps in before the point in time at which your co-founder or your CEO is going to have to make that decision of we need someone who can do those things. So getting those reps in early is going to be, I think, really important.
Also, I'm just thinking personality types too, right? The stereotypical engineer is introverted. They don't want to talk to anybody. They just want to work by themselves. And then it's like, how do you then evolve that person to be a manager be not even social, but you're dealing with other people.
I would make the argument of why try to change that person. If they're your best engineer and they will be your best engineer, don't put them in a job they're incompetent in.
Yeah.
Keep them in the job that they're the best in. Right.
Yeah.
And don't, like, the best engineers at some of these big firms, they have zero people reporting to them. Right. Their time is just best spent at the keyboard. So
yeah,
let it be, you know, and that's part of, I think, the early stage CTO who finds themselves in that position. Part of what they need to reckon with is, what is my role here? What is my strategic value to the business? Is it in managing the team in the department, or am I better off really being deep in the code?
Yeah. Yeah. And then there's actually even research that says, like, as an example, your best salesperson is almost never going to be your best sales manager.
Right.
So keep your people. Yeah. Keep, unless they want to be a manager, like, keep those best people where they shine the most.
Totally. It's really common to promote to the point of incompetency, right? Yeah. So you get promoted because you're the best in your job. You get promoted again because you're the best in that job. You stop getting promoted because you're no longer very good at your job.
Right? Yeah, exactly. And the second question I wanted to ask with the two types of CTO is, so if you had somebody that originally built out the first, you know, iterations of the product, and you now have a CTO that's coming in and they're looking at the code base and they're like, this is a huge mess. I'm sure you've seen a lot of cases like that. How can a non-technical partner or team, how can they manage through that transition period?
So I think that partially you need more than one opinion, right? And I think it may cost you some money to get those other opinions, because really taking a deep dive into an existing code base can take a lot of time and effort. But I think you need more than one opinion, and I think you need to really understand why the new developer, the new CTO, the new firm is saying that it's unsavable, or that it's such a mess we need to stop everything else that we're doing. Because we have our own opinions. I have my own opinions of what good code looks like. I have my own opinions of what good architecture looks like. But there are other opinions, and they can be valid as well, and are valid. And some of them are good, some of them aren't. But the reasoning I would have for that transition, or that rewrite, or whatever it may end up being, would have to be rooted in the features we're delivering to users, our speed and ability to do it, the quality of the product we're giving to users. If it's purely about, oh, they shouldn't have used that type of database, and this library sucks, and I don't like this language, and that, the users don't care. They just don't care if it's written in Java, JavaScript, Python, they don't. So the reasoning for that rewrite has to be rooted in the business's KPIs, not in, I don't like that thing.
Yeah. So, like, one of the examples, or one of the common situations I see, is founders coming to like an American dev shop and saying, hey, for the last 3-4 years, we've had this outsourced team out in Pakistan or India develop it. And now the American company is looking at it and saying, like, oh man, they just overcomplicated the code base. Like, would you then advise that startup team to rewrite and clean up the code, or just kind of continue to build on that?
My answer is really going to lie in the rest of the context. How much money do they have? Did they just raise? How many users do they have? There has to be a business justification. It can't just be as blanket as, those guys wrote bad code, or, you know, we don't like the way that they did this, or it's just more complicated than it should be. Ultimately, you can spend 6 months untangling the code. You've delivered no features. You've delivered no value to users. Can you survive that? If you have the money and the ability to do that, and you've gotten second and third opinions, and everyone says, yeah, this is a mess, you know, you really got to start over, and you can, then do it. But if you're in a position where you just don't have that kind of capital or runway or headway or whatever it is, it's not an option to you, right?
Yeah. But kind of leaves your new partners in a bit of a pickle, because now they have to be the ones working with the complex, messy codes.
Well, then that's up to them then. Either they're in or they're out, right? I mean, we've received situations like that where we said, look, we just don't think we're the right partner for this because this is a total mess and we're not going to be able to do it in the timeline that you want, in the way that you want, and meet our own quality standards.
Fair enough.
Right?
Yeah.
At the same time, we've taken on code bases that I think are just atrocious, knowing that if we put, you know, 20K of development into the thing, we can get them to that next funding round and clean it up later.
Mm. Okay, fair enough. And it's actually a really good segue to my next question, which is technical debt being such a common challenge for early stage companies. So for one, for those who don't know what technical debt is, could you explain what it is and why it's such a big problem for scaling companies?
Yeah, so technical debt really comes in two forms. One is the known purposefully acquired debt, where we are making a decision that we know we are going to have to undo later, but it gets us to where we want to be faster and cheaper. And that is debt that you take on strategically. There's also the technical debt where you don't really know you're making a mess because there's just going to be changes in requirements. You put something out there and you find out users really didn't like that in this way and they want it in a different way. And to go make that change means undoing a lot of what you've done. Not just changing it, but really undoing it. I think, you know, that type of debt, a decent analogy is if you build a two-story house and then someone says, well, I want to put two more stories on it. Well, that foundation was only poured for two stories. It can't hold the weight of two more stories, right? So that's that change in requirements, that where you laid a bad foundation and the only way to have a four-story house now is to relay the foundation, tear it all down.
Yeah, it's a good analogy.
It's an okay. I want to find a better one.
It's okay. Easy to understand. So.
And honestly, we use buildings and building analogies a lot in software. And what you often run into, to go back to the question about dev teams overseas and bringing that back to the States and finding out that it's a mess, oftentimes that comes down to having improper management overseeing those dev teams. And so we talk about ourselves as a general contractor, making sure that the drywall doesn't go up before the plumbing, right? And a lot of times you end up seeing these workarounds because the drywall went up and now the plumbing's outside of the drywall, you know?
Yeah.
So that's that technical debt kind of fiasco people can find themselves in.
So then how can product managers, startup founders or leaders prevent technical debt from happening, from becoming a major issue down the line?
Yeah, so I want to be clear that technical debt is something we knowingly take on often. So the goal isn't always to prevent it, but it's to be strategic about it, be aware of it. So making sure that your teams are tracking that debt, whether that's just in a Google Doc writing down what it is, or Jira tickets, or, you know, however sophisticated or not, just keeping track of it every time you make a decision, knowing that that is a decision that we're probably going to need to come back and clean up is important. But for us, that often gets caught at the code review stage, right? We put in a requirement, developers implement something in a certain way, we go and review the code before we merge it, and that's where the person reviewing the code goes, oh, yeah, he's right, or she's right, that developer, but that does create a problem down the line. And so as long as you're tracking it and aware of it, it's totally fine, and you're going to have it because you don't have Google's budget, right? So you're going to have to accept debt.
It's always the question of budget. How much money, how much time do you have? What can you do with what you have now? Yeah, there's no guarantee you're going to raise capital later down the line.
Right. A lot of engineering teams lose sight of that. They function more like artists, where the business is, you know, paying them to do their art, and they build this beautiful, awesome system, but it never really meets the needs of the user. Whereas we look at ourselves as contributing to the business. So all of our KPIs are really business KPIs, not, like I said, awards or design functions or, you know, whatever it may be. So that to me is just a huge disconnect of like, everything depends on budget and timeline and resources and client needs. And, you know, that's how your dev team should run.
Yeah. And it's getting your clients to think more like a business savvy entrepreneur rather than a visionary almost.
Right. Yeah. And yeah, we do a lot of coaching, for lack of a better term.
I relate to that.
You know, like, get rid of that. Like, yes, you're right. That idea is great. Or yes, you're totally right. The way we implemented that isn't perfect, but it's enough. It's so minor. It's fine. Let's move on and just keep pushing.
Yeah.
Lost on a lot of people.
Of course, because it's still ego, going back to that, it's full circle. Everyone wants to present the best version of whatever they're producing. And, you know, sometimes you got to let it go to get to where you actually want to go.
Yep, totally. Yeah, it's really hard. It's when you're in it and you're the founder and you're running it and you're working 100 whatever hours a week on the thing, it's really hard to let it be good enough and not perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. So we are coming up on time, and I'm wondering if there's anything else that you want to share in terms of advice or stories with our audience.
I think you've kind of hit all the highlights I wanted to talk about, to be honest.
Oh, that's good. Got thorough. Actually, I do have one more question, because there's just so much emergence of AI and technology that's happening now. And I'm just curious, from your perspective, from everything that you've seen, like, where do you see the future of tech going?
No, it's moving so fast. It's just so, it's so hard to predict. And it's hard to predict the future because I often feel like I think of something and it's there tomorrow. You know, it's like, to really look into the future in that way. But I do think that there's some really cool AI coming out right now. We have a long ways to go with it. It's exciting looking, but it's still very surface level. And so I think getting to a point where we can really just describe business requirements and walk away with designs or walk away with code or, you know, product itself, I think that's the thing in the future that's coming that I'm most excited about. Because it allows and opens the door for anyone to really build a product and start a company. Because what AI is not going to be great at is that ideation portion and the, you know, what's the real user need and the business problem that we're solving. Building designs, writing code, it'll be able to do.
I think what makes you unique, and I can see why you've had such a success record, is that you're able to tap into both your technical thinking as well as that, like, business conceptual thinking as well, which is very rare. You either have a technical mindset or a creative visionary. And I think you're able to marry both of them, which is, you know, why you're so successful.
Yeah. Thank you. I agree. And I think that it's what a lot of developers are missing, is that business mindset that ultimately we have to contribute to the business. But I think for me, I equally enjoy building a business as I do a web app or a mobile app or a, you know, architecture or whatever it is. I get nearly the same enjoyment out of both.
Yeah, I think I'm very similar too, where it's like, I need that, like, creative art design space, but I also love just making things happen and, like, making that sale and just, you know, building business, building process. It's fun to have both of them. Yeah.
Totally. It's a good balance.
It is
unique though. I mean, that's there's not a lot of it out there.
Yeah. I don't know if you're similar like me, but for me, if I dive too deep into one over the other, I just kind of start losing it. Like if I'm too much in the business and I don't get enough of the creative, I'm like, I want to get out. And then vice versa. Yeah. If I'm too much in the creative, I'm just like, I don't even know what's happening with the world right now.
Totally. Yeah. It's time spent in the business versus time spent on the business in many ways.
Yeah.
But I think the thing for me, and it sounds like it may be similar for you, is at the end of the day, my work is also my hobby. And so I think I'd be doing it either way.
Yeah. It goes back to the entrepreneurs being an addict, right? Full circle conversation. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's really what it is. So.
Yeah. Like we don't have hobbies outside of what we do. This is our hobby.
If I had a different job, this is what I'd be doing in my free time. I'm just fortunate enough to be in a position where I was lucky enough to have a hobby that pays well. I was lucky enough to have a hobby I could do 9 to 5. And, you know, some days I wish it was only 9 to 5. But,
I was going to say, like 9 to 9.
But I see so many people out there, so many of my friends and whatnot that have these hobbies that don't pay well and that don't, you know, provide them a job opportunity. You know, it's a blessing that I don't really even fully understand in a sense.
Yeah. It's usually the opposite. The hobbies are costing them versus making them money. Yeah.
Well, like my hobby actually is really expensive, right? But people give me money to do it. And so and I get to play with other people's AWS accounts. I get to play with other people's software development teams. I get to, you know, and then you go raise money. I get to play with someone else's money. It's all just truly a hobby in a sense.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much, Daniel. I had such an enjoyment speaking with you today. If our audience wants to find you, what's the best way to get in contact with you?
Yeah, the best way is our website, milemarker.io, or my LinkedIn, which I don't know that link by heart, but one of those two is definitely the best way.
Awesome. We'll make sure to drop in the link below. So thank you so much, Daniel.
Awesome. Thank you so much. This was great.
We hope you have enjoyed listening to our latest episode, and we would like to invite you to check out our other episodes for more thought-provoking discussions and inspiring stories. And don't forget to follow us on social media at Wander Studio and listen to a new episode every week.